It sounds like they are saying, how can we make this as hard as possible so we can do away with SNAP and other food assistance programs without actually saying we're going to do away with SNAP and other food assistance programs? Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Bold and the Brave, a Parent Leader podcast. Thank you all for joining us, whether you're watching us on YouTube or listening to us in your car, in your office. Welcome back after a brief summer break. We took a brief but well-deserved break, but we're back at it again. We have a great episode for you. For those that don't know who I am, my name is Carlos Maldonado. I lead the communications team here with the National Parent Leadership Institute. I'm usually behind the camera recording the podcast and producing the podcast, but I'm back again for another episode. And I am joined by my friend, my coworker, my compadre, Hobson McCain, also with the NPLI team. Hobson, how's it going?
It's going well, Carlos, and we're super happy that you're back on the podcast. We're really excited for today's episode. And just for everybody who doesn't know, I am Hobson McCain. I'm the Operations and Special Initiative Associate with the National Parent Leadership Institute. We are really, really excited today to have a conversation with some partners, some consultants, some parent leaders who are doing a lot of great work in the community. We're joined by Carolyn Vega from Share Our Strength, Anthony Bonner from Memphis, and Z from Hawaii. Welcome to you all. We are very, very excited to have you here. Like I said, we have a great conversation, so let's just jump right into it.
Yeah. Before we go into our conversation with our guests, we just wanted to set the tone for the episode and just tell folks a little bit of what we're going to be talking about today. So today's podcast episode, we're going to be talking about SNAP and other food assistance programs. You know, what's happening in the most recent budget bill that passed Congress, what's happening in our states, and what is needed and what folks can do at their local level for those that are worried around this issue. So like Hobson said, we have three wonderful guests. And so we're going to get started with Carolyn from Share Our Strength, our wonderful partner organization. Carolyn, we're going to ask you if you can explain a little bit about what SNAP and these other food assistance programs are for our audience.
There are actually 16 federal food assistance programs. Congress sets the general structure for these programs and provides most of the funding, and then states implement them. These programs do things like support meals in schools and childcare centers. They help food banks get food to distribute, or they help pregnant women and new parents get formula and food. SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is our nation's largest food assistance program with the broadest eligibility. SNAP offers eligible households money to buy food at grocery stores and other approved retailers. Usually that money comes on a debit-like EBT card.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn, so much for sharing that. It sounds like these like assistance programs are really important for families and communities around the country. And it makes me wonder just how did each of you get started in SNAP and food assistance program education and advocacy? And I wonder if we start off with Z.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Hobson and Carlos. I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks so much for asking me to come share my experience. I grew up in Southern California, and that's where I first encountered the SNAP program. Back in the day, it was called food stamps. I since have moved to Hawaii. I've been here for 10 years. I remember back being 22, 23 years old and needing some assistance with food, and substance use is a part of my past. And at that particular time, I was in a treatment facility, which is fantastic, helped to save my life. And they really introduced me to SNAP. Went down to the SNAP office in Southern California and walked out with a bunch of stamps. You know, it was kind of traumatic-ish experience, right? Because I had no idea what anything looked like. And at that point, I was able to feed myself. And I knew about SNAP from that. It was a couple of decades later when I needed it again for my family, right? Myself, my child's dad, right? We were all living together and things got hard. My story, not unique, right? But definitely has some pieces. We all have different stories. And dad has some disability issues, some diagnoses, and needed some caregiving. And so we were a one-income household at the time. I also had a newborn, and we just needed some extra help. And I knew that SNAP existed. And so living here in Hawaii, I was able to reach out. I was able to help to take care of the family. The education and advocacy piece really came about from realizing the stigma attached to SNAP and what that looks like, which is really just a poverty thing. Like, the more I learned about it, the classism and what all that looks like. And then it really just became, why are we not going out of our way to make this easier for people who are hungry? Right. And that really began my journey at the state legislature, and then doing some work with some national associations and partners around sharing lived experience. Because there's always a huge stigma around lived experience, right? The whole like, oh, we're the children who step in and the grownups say, come tell us your problems. And then the grownups close the door and say, let's fix it. And so really when the opportunity presented itself a couple of years ago to be like, no, not a child, an adult who deserves a seat at the table. Let's have the conversation from that perspective. That's really what that looked like. And I look forward to being able to share a little bit later, you know, with more of the questions. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. And I wonder if we can go to Anthony in terms of just how did you get started in SNAP and food assistance program education and advocacy?
Yes, I think mine kind of mirrors the same. Grew up on the system back when it was food stamps. Then, you know, two of my children's mothers, they was on food stamps when they had SNAP here in Tennessee. And just through that, just seeing how that was, and my income as a barber never really allocated for me to be able to get it, even though there were plenty of times throughout my adult life that I could have used it for myself. It wasn't until 3 years ago when my youngest son, he's now 13, where he came to move in with me, where I was then myself able to qualify for the SNAP benefit program. And for me, it's been a real help, real boost. And just with him coming to live with me, I was kind of really starting to get into the swing of just starting to advocate. First was just going through looking for my own resources, and then just seeing the need, being a full-time single father, that the need to really share my story. And that's what led me into joining PLTI and then eventually the National SNAP Parent Council with Share Our Strengths. And, you know, that led me all here today.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you for sharing your story. Sounds like there was some shared experience around accessibility issues and need being the thing that kind of made you aware of the program as a whole. Carolyn, I wonder if I can throw that question back at you.
Sure. My story is a little bit different. I started off in college studying nutrition, thinking that maybe I was going to do research or maybe go to med school and be a doctor. But I had a great professor who challenged me once when I was kind of telling him what my future plans were, to say, like, I think we all know we should be eating broccoli. Like, I don't think we need another research study to tell us that. But we really need to know why more people aren't eating broccoli or aren't able to eat broccoli. So I guess that was the question that radicalized me and decided, you know, pivot into doing more nutrition policy. And so I was started off working in child nutrition program administration at the state level, and then moved over to the nonprofit side and working on policy. So again, started more on child nutrition programs, and I've grown to learn more about SNAP. I'm always humbled to work with amazing people like Z and Anthony and try never to be one of the adults in the room pushing people out, and instead learning from your experience, which is so valuable and what it's really all about.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, folks like you are the reason that some of these changes are being made in community. So we're definitely appreciative to have you here. And we talked a lot, you know, we have Z from Hawaii, we have Anthony from Memphis, and we know that these SNAP and food assistance programs are assisting people around the country. And so I wonder, you know, about the differences in terms of like what the work looks like in Memphis, what the work looks like in Hawaii. And so Anthony, I think I'm going to throw this back at you, but what does the work look like right now in Memphis? What are some of the things that you're doing right now in Memphis in terms of food advocacy?
So first off, last summer, the summer EBT program was stripped from Shelby County. It was stripped from Shelby County and Davidson County and about two other counties. The governor decided they wanted to look at ways they can save money, so they cut back on removing it from certain counties. Just so happened they took it from the two largest counties in the state of Tennessee, which is Shelby County and Davidson County. Shelby County is what controls the Memphis metropolitan area. Davidson County is what controls the Nashville metropolitan area. So just really just that, I had to kind of get the word out because it wasn't known. That wasn't even known. People just kind of found out throughout the summers what was going on and happening. So just kind of really letting people know, educate about that. I worked with a couple of other organizations that, you know, do food drives throughout the summer and throughout the year. So that's just one aspect of what you're kind of dealing with the SNAP benefit program. As far as that, it's a necessity in this city for the most part. Memphis is the largest Black metropolitan area. I mean, yeah, city in the country. We surpassed Detroit last year with the highest population of African Americans within a city's population. And it also has one of the highest level of poverty in the nation. So that means a great deal of the citizens of this city depend on that benefits just to be able to provide the family. You're looking at different cultures, large ethnic cultures like Indian and different African cultures that are all here. You know, people that are all, you know, very, you know, needing it as well too. So when I look at the SNAP benefit program here in this city, I look at it as a real necessary crutch to help people not just feed their family, but to be able to have a little bit more to where they can strive for what they want to be able to put themselves in more successful position.
Yeah, no, sorry. I mean, one, it sounds like, very sorry to hear that the benefits are leaving in that area or are being reduced in that area, but it sounds like the community is doing its best to try to come together and provide alternative means in terms of like those food banks that you were talking about, and even just getting the word out and letting folks know that the change is there. So definitely some great work coming out of Memphis from you, Anthony, and very appreciative of what you're doing. And like Anthony said, Memphis is a very urban community, very metropolized. And I know, Z, you come from a little bit of a different background. What is the work looking like in Hawaii right now?
I really appreciate the question. Thanks, Hobson. I was listening to you, Anthony, and talking about the city, and I'm sitting here, you know, on my 1 acre of land in the southernmost part of the United States, where it's mostly lava rock and a 45-minute to an hour drive to the nearest real kind supermarket, right? And all of those things. And I'm like, wow, the city, right? It's been a long time since I've lived in a city. And so really here in Hawaii, I mean, I'm sure most of the listeners know, but Hawaii, you have all separate islands, right? And so a lot of people hear about Hawaii, and what they do is they think Oahu, whether they've ever heard of Oahu or not. Oahu is Honolulu, that's Waikiki, that's where the tourists come, right? The vacationing. And they have a bunch of food and a bunch of highways and a bunch of traffic, right? That's not the island that I live on, right? I live on Hawaii Island, and Hawaii Island is the largest geographically. You can geographically fit all of the other islands into here, and there's less than 300,000 people. So really what it looks like here, the whole island is pretty much a rural area, right? You have the two smaller cities, right? One on each side of the island, but it's different here. I would say in my small community, right, with my neighbors and what it looks like, we do have the two supermarkets, right? But if I'm going in to buy a can of soup, the price is at least 1.5 times to 3 times higher than it is if I drive for 45 minutes, and that's just to the other supermarket. So we live in a food desert, right? That's what things look like here. And so when talking about what we're doing for SNAP and what we're doing for, you know, here in the state of Hawaii, I would say it's so different because the needs, even on varying sides of the island, right, are so great. You could literally get on an airplane in Kona and arrive in Honolulu before I could drive from where I live over to Hilo, where my kid goes to college, right? So it's like things are so, from the transportation piece, from all of it. And so really I'm giving that kind of background before I'm answering the question, because you really have to understand the rural nature of where it is that we live here. And so there are bills that come up around SNAP all the time, right? We're trying to expand the program. Hawaii actually, awesome, back in February of this year, 2025, they expanded the BBCE program, which basically for SNAP means the broad-based, the C, I always forget what it stands for. Can you help me out there, Carolyn?
Broad-based categorical eligibility.
Categorical, because that's a word we should all know, right? So they expanded the BBCE program, which really had always been, as long as you were 100% of the federal poverty level, the BBCE was you could be 200% in your gross income and 100% in your net income. Hawaii, February of 2025, they did away with the net income testing. So as long as your gross income was under 200%, and I got to tell you, 50,000 more individuals in the state of Hawaii were able to qualify for SNAP as a result. Wow. And so we have our state legislators that are decent, right, that understand what some of these things are and that are trying to make the changes around it. As far as in my community, I would love to tell you that we feel the difference, but it's still six, you know, it's $11 for a loaf of bread, right? I mean, that's what things look like here in Hawaii, even not in the rural area. So we're advocating, we're doing work, more food banks are opening up, more ministry type things from some of, you know, the religious and spiritual organizations. And then you have nonprofits around what we call the Aina. The Aina is the land. It's sacred here, right? In Hawaii for the indigenous people, Kanaka Maoli, like the Aina is, it's incredibly sacred. So you have a lot more people. This may not be known, right? For SNAP benefits, you can use your SNAP benefits to buy seeds for fruit bearing and for vegetables. You're allowed to use your SNAP for that. So there's definitely the nonprofit organizations that are teaching people to do that here. There's a lot of work going on. The community is fantastic, trying to take care of each other with a lot of these issues. Of course, I don't think the community should have to, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. So thanks.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And then, you know, sometimes when our legislators or our policies fall short, the community is all that we have to lean on. So it's great to hear that both in Hawaii and in Memphis, you know, the community is kind of filling some of those gaps. Of course, we're always going to advocate for the folks who are supposed to fill the gaps. I think I'm passing it off to Carlos for this next piece, and then I'll keep it going.
Yeah. Thank you, Hobson. And thank you, Anthony and Z. Z, if we could stay with you for a little bit. We know through previous work that you have done with the MPLI that you have a background and expertise in things like analyzing and advocating for and building inclusion in systems. Being that SNAP is this thing that is helping a lot of people, is there anything that you're bringing in about inclusion as it relates to SNAP and nutritional benefits?
I really appreciate the question, Carlos. And I also really like that you said out loud for the listeners that you've worked with me before, only because it means that what I'm about to say won't be surprising, right? Inclusion is a word that I don't hate, as opposed to some other words that I dislike. But when you think about the word inclusion, inclusion is something that people in power decide that they want to do for those that are not in power, right? I'm a decision maker. And so I am choosing to include those who are not decision makers to get their input. That is what inclusion is about. We typically talk about inclusion with regards to the disability community, right? Is there access? Is there inclusion around? But again, it basically, the premise of inclusion is that there's no power present, right? You have to wait to be included by those who have the power. So I'm saying that out loud because that's what I do and I say things out loud. But there is some inclusion that's going on across the country in some of the SNAP systems systemically here in Hawaii. But I'm also going to say out loud on the record that I don't want inclusion. I want power sharing, right? Like, it's like when we talk about equality and equity, right? Equality is great, but really I want equity. And if we're really talking honesty, I want justice, right? So I feel like inclusion is a step to power sharing, but what I want is power sharing. So yes, here in the state of, you know, Hawaii, they are working a little bit on creating some councils at some of the nonprofit at the state level, bringing people with lived experience in. It's not as great as I would like it to be. It's not as consistent as I would like it to be at any level. I'm going to share for just a quick minute, like, you know, a story that I had, you know, being a SNAP recipient, I would call the phone line, right? Because you're calling and you're trying to get a hold of someone because I'm online and it's not working. And so I'm sitting on hold. And we're talking average time of 2.5 hours, you know, sitting on hold. And one of the things, to Hawaii's credit, I promise you I'll get to it in about 3 seconds at the end of the story, but you would call and every 3 minutes, and I'm not joking, like exaggerating when I say every 3 minutes, but every 3 minutes a recording would come on that would say, if you'd like to leave a voicemail, press 1. If you'd like to receive a call back, press 2. And if you'd like to remain on hold, press 3. If you did not hit the number 3, you were disconnected. So every 3 minutes, I have to hit the number 3. Do you know what that means? That means that I can't wash the dishes because now my hands are wet and I can't my phone won't identify my finger hitting the button 3, like the number 3, right? This is what it looked like. And I reached out to the deputy director. I reached out to the director. I reached out to the legislator. I testified on bills at the state legislature. It took 17 months. And they changed it to a 15-minute rotation as opposed to 3, right? So yay, right? When we talk about the policy changes that we want in SNAP, of course, want more broad-based, you know, eligibility, want more people to be able to afford food. But what we also want is people to be able to retain the benefits that they have, right? To not be so for what happens when you work? In what universe, what job can I sit on hold for 2.5 hours hitting the number 3 every 3 minutes and work? Right. And we are right now a country that does not guarantee paid family leave. Right. So trying, they're all like everything intersects with each other. So again, to Hawaii's credit, they hear it, they make changes, things work painfully slowly, which I totally understand. But I think when it comes to the inclusion piece and some of the work that I'm trying to do in the systems, both here at the state level and at the national level, is really just out louding the stuff that people don't want to say. Right. For me, that's the inclusion. And every time I use the verbiage out loud, there's someone who says, oh, you mean elevate. No, I do not mean elevate. Things that are on the table get elevated. Out louding is about digging out the stuff from the moldy foundation of the earth, washing it off so that it's palatable to put on the table so that other people can then elevate it, right? So when I'm speaking anywhere at the national level to electeds, to nonprofits, you know, again, at the national level or other states, I talk about the lived experience piece all the time because lived experience is not just lived experience with SNAP. I have lived experience as a disabled person. I have lived experience as a caregiver for disabled people. I have lived experience with poverty, lived experience with SNAP, lived experience with being on Quest, which is our version of Medicaid. I also have lived experience as a therapist, right? Lived experience as a drug addict and an alcoholic, being homeless under a bridge and now turning it around and being able to work with others. So there's such a stigma attached to the lived experience, the verbiage, when we talk about it, that I think that one of the ways that I'm trying to breed inclusion for the goal of power sharing, but trying at the very least for inclusion, is really just trying to help whoever I'm talking to realize that they have lived experience as well. That it's not a bad word. You can be a professional and have lived experience. You can have initials after your name and have lived experience. And I just want everyone to talk about their own lived experience whenever given a mic, because I think that's how we continue to make changes within the systems around inclusion, because power sharing is the goal. And so that's what I do in the SNAP world, right? When I'm invited as a professional, I make it a point to talk about my disability and my lived experience with poverty and SNAP with a microphone everywhere, every chance I can. So I hope that that kind of answered your question there, Carlos.
It did. Thank you. And I love everything you just said. Power sharing is the goal. If we walk with nothing else out of this conversation, that's something that I think we can all take with us. Power sharing is the goal. Above inclusion. Inclusion is all well and good. Right, but power sharing is the goal. Anthony, you're coming at this from a different background, similar background, but a little different in that you are a dad providing for your children. Is there anything you want to share around that as a dad? How has engaging in this been for you as a father?
Man, first of all, yo, Z, just like, man, what you were just saying about mm-hmm. inclusion, just, hey, man. Man, you said a lot there, but you know, and it, you know, and it's motivated me because I'm not just coming at it. I don't come into this work just not as a father, a single father, but it's I'm a black man. I'm an entrepreneur. I just had a situation where I needed rent assistance, and as an entrepreneur, I couldn't get the assistance that people have. Because they like your income is up and down and it could be good. Yeah, you may be bad today, but tomorrow. And it's like, this is the reason why, you know. And then you bring in like a child, you know, I'm a father of one single and my child, but I have four others. So that's, you know, and they don't live with me. So I'm having to, you know, help provide for multiple households while still trying to make sure that my household, and you know, before my child goes in, you know, came in to live with me, it was just me trying to provide for my household. And that, and I think like that's the part where I kind of really touch base on. It's like, you know, it's I can represent for the single person out here that doesn't have kids, that is out here trying to make a way for themselves. And you just look at like recent, I just got an email, you know, this past week. My benefits are getting up to $40 from what it is. And, you know, and the fact that I have a child, I don't have to qualify for those. I don't qualify for having to abide by those work requirements that the reconciliation bill just added on. And it just made me think about, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm lucky in a sense, but like, what if I didn't? So now it's like, I have to be reporting that. And, you know, at this point in age, I've been a barber I've been in my craft for 16 years. You know, I don't always work. I may not work 20-30 hours a week, you know, and I just, that sucks. There's so many people out here that need the assistance, and it just seems like they just make it hard, or there's this stigma that's placed on you that, oh, you're not working hard enough, or you're not trying hard enough, or, you know, you're lazy, you know, you're just using up. And it's like, that's so not true. Most of people, like, and it's going back, like, I love that inclusion piece. It made me think about something that I said when we was talking, when we first was gathering for the SNAP Benefit Council in D.C. back in April. And, you know, we're all coming from different states, different backgrounds, different cultures. And like I just had to say, you know, inclusion can be okay, but at times there needs, like, you know, I think, you know, you got to be careful about trying to create policy. Because I feel like that when you a policy can never really be a one-fit-all situation. There needs to be some exclusivity within that possibility to address certain age groups or certain demographics or certain cultural. Because the inclusion should be that we're all sitting at the table making the decisions together. You know, not necessarily like, well, I'm going to throw this blanket policy out here and I hope that you fit up in it, because it's more than likely there's somebody going to be left out. But if everybody is sitting at the table to make the decision, then we all can be successful. And that's kind of like what I look to do in my work, is just making sure that people are all sitting at the table. And not just, you know, a lot of, you're so, you know, these type of benefits, SNAP benefits, Medicaid benefits, you know, there's stigmas around that you only have to, you got to be a woman or you got to have kids, you know. And there's so many, you know, fathers or men that don't get assistance or are unable to find assistance because they feel like they can't, or these programs just make it, have these stipulations to make it harder. And it's like, you know, we care, we struggle, you know, at the same time, yes, I'm a man, but that doesn't mean that I can't, you know, get assistance. And I think like, that's where I come in with the work, is just making sure that people understand that you can't just look at it in one way. You can't just look at these certain people, that there are so many more. There are so many more. Like, I'm lucky that I was able to, you know, my sons came and I was able to qualify to be able to feed him. But I just think about what if, you know, and I think about all those past years where, like Z said, like, my lived experience is not just doing this. I've experienced poverty. I've experienced homelessness. I've experienced all these things. I've experienced needing assistance and couldn't get it. You know, and getting turned down, and I've experienced having to be a man in society and just pick up my bootstraps and just get it done. Even if I'm struggling, I got to struggle silently, you know, because nobody's going to really care. You know, I think that's why I speak up and why I say the things, and I put myself in these councils and allow myself in these organizations like PLTI, just to give more men, more fathers, the strength to be able to speak up and say things and not feel like that you're less than a man, that you're not less than. You know what I mean? If you're going out doing whatever you need to do for your family, then that's, you know, to me, you're doing a darn good job. Whether it's you going out getting a job or you're going out asking and getting the resources that you need, you're doing what's necessary. You know, so that's where my that's what I like to add into, and just what I do and things of that nature.
Yeah, thank you, Anthony. That is definitely sorely needed, what you just touched on at the end. Bring in more men into the work, bring in more fathers into the work. Without that stigma that if you're coming in asking for resources, that doesn't make you any less of a man. That doesn't make you any less of a father or less of a caregiver. Like you said, you're doing what you need to provide for your family. And it, at the end of the day, that's what matters. So thank you, Anthony, for what you're doing. Thank you, Z, for what you're doing as well. And I wanted to pivot a little bit to the current state of affairs in our country and the legislation that's being passed, the legislation that's being proposed. Carolyn, we're going to come back to you a little bit because of your work in education and your work in advocacy and the expertise you have around SNAP. Are there any things that people need to know about the big budget bill that just recently passed? What do people need to know in regards to SNAP and food assistance programs from that bill?
There's a lot, unfortunately. So there are some more technical changes that may start being implemented at any time now, and those will mainly affect SNAP eligibility and benefit levels. And then the reconciliation bill that passed back in July also included some really big structural changes to SNAP. Those won't go into effect for a year or two, maybe longer, depending on your state. But states are definitely thinking about those changes already and may start planning for them in the coming year. And although, again, those changes mainly affect states or counties, I think they are going to ultimately affect SNAP participants and all the people who need this assistance. So bear with me because, again, it's a lot, but I think it's important for people to understand. So starting with some of those technical changes, one, the bill expands who is subject to time limits on SNAP participation because of compliance with the strictest work requirements. So it used to be in SNAP that people 18 to 49 years old without kids had to prove that they were working at least 20 hours per week to receive SNAP. And if your hours drop below 20 hours a week, or you lost your job, or you had trouble documenting your hours, think of Anthony showing how many hours you're cutting hair, you could only receive SNAP for up to 3 months every 3 years. A few years ago, that got changed to adults ages 18 to 54 being subject to these time limits. But in exchange, there were some exemptions for veterans, adults experiencing homelessness, and young adults recently aged out of the foster care system. But now, after the reconciliation bill passed in July, it's going to be adults ages 18 to 64, so already up another 10 years, subject to these time limits. The exemptions have gone away, and for the first time, time limits will apply to adults with dependent kids ages 14 and older. So if you are a parent with teens, and again, you have trouble documenting your hours or your hours drop below 20 hours a week, you're going to be subject to that 3 month time limit. For yourself, not for your kids, but again, that can really affect a whole household's benefit. That's technical change number one. Number two, limited how states can ask for waivers from those time limits. So again, that'll affect a lot of people that maybe they lived in a state or an area without enough jobs, their state got a waiver from those time limits. Now those options are more limited. The bill also further limited SNAP eligibility for non-citizens. Important to note, just because of misinformation out there, that immigrants without legal status have never been eligible for SNAP. And there were several limits on immigrants with legal status since 1996. But now eligibility is going to be further limited to only green card holders, certain Cuban and Haitian immigrants, and lawful residents from places like Micronesia that are covered by something called the Compacts of Free Association. So, again, this rhetoric around SNAP is drawing people to immigrate illegally to the United States really isn't true. That's not how the rules work. But now eligibility is being further limited for non-citizens. The bill also eliminated an option to include internet costs when calculating income deductions, and that can affect benefit levels and may, in some instances, affect eligibility. It goes back to some things he was talking about earlier about broad-based categorical eligibility and gross income versus net income. So again, pretty technical, but again, it's just something that's going to limit eligibility and benefit levels. Similar, that limited when households can use what's called the standard utility allowance based on when they receive federal or state energy assistance. So this is just something that's going to increase administrative burden. More people would have to document their actual utility costs when calculating those income deductions, and it may serve to also limit eligibility and benefits levels. The bill also restricts future benefit increases that would have better kept SNAP in line with the latest, like nutrition guidance and food availability and shopping and food prep habits. Now SNAP is going to be back to just being adjusted annually for inflation, and that is it. no periodic adjustments to help Snap keep up with changes in how people shop and eat. So that was a lot. But now going on to the big structural changes that I'm really most concerned about. Currently, the federal government pays for the full cost of SNAP benefits and half the cost of administering the program. And states, or in some cases counties, pay for the other half of those administrative costs. Starting next year, in October of 2026, states will have to pay 75% of the cost of running SNAP. That means the staff, the computer systems, the EBT cards, those call centers that put you on a 3-minute or 15-minute loop to stay connected. And then obviously covering those higher administrative costs is going to be harder when states are dealing with changes that make the program harder to administer, like time limits on applying to more people. And then for most states, starting in October of 2027, they'll have to pay a portion of SNAP benefit costs for the first time ever. And what they pay for benefit costs is going to be based on what's called the payment error rate. The payment error rate is all overpayments or underpayments made by the state, whether that's because of misunderstandings or mistakes by households or because of administrative errors by state or county workers. And so the law, and I think a misguided attempt to lower those administrative errors, creates this tiered structure where states with the lowest error rates won't have to pay a portion of benefit costs, but other states, depending on what their rate is, will have to pay 5%, 10%, or 15% of benefit costs. Some states may get to delay that benefit cost share by 1 to 2 years if they have a really high error rate, but eventually this will apply to all states. And just for a frame of reference, only 9 states had an error rate for 2024 that was low enough to avoid the benefit cost shift. So this, again, is currently likely to apply to many states. And again, with all these other technical changes that I talked about, states are worried that they're going to have higher error rates as they figure out how to implement all of these things. And so all of this will have a really drastic impact on state budgets. And even though states get a little bit of lead time for planning for what their cost share will be based on their error rate, like it's like based on 3 years prior error rate, you know, it still varies year by year. So that's really concerning that states will have maybe that up and down from year to year. And again, really massive costs that they're not used to covering. And so I think that's really important too, because even if you don't participate in SNAP, this will affect you because it will affect your state's budget for everything else like education and roads. But, you know, it's a little early to know exactly how states are going to handle this. They're still wrapping their minds around. How do they lower their error rate? How do they potentially absorb these costs, both on SNAP and on other changes from the reconciliation bill on Medicaid and other things? I know, it's a lot.
It is a lot. And at least to me, it sounds like they are saying, how can we make this as hard as possible so we can do away with SNAP and other food assistance programs without actually saying we're going to do away with SNAP and other food assistance programs?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when Anthony referenced summer EBT being cut in his county in Tennessee, summer EBT is a slightly different program from SNAP, but operates pretty similarly. It's just tailored to families with kids who receive free or reduced price meals at schools to receive a SNAP-like benefit over the summer. And summer EBT should be available across the country like SNAP currently is, but states can choose to opt in or not to summer EBT, and it's a new program, so not all states have yet, or Tennessee started but then decided to stop. We're worried that SNAP might be like that. If states say, ugh, we can't really stomach this uncertainty and these high costs potentially, maybe we should just stop doing SNAP in our state. And that would be devastating.
Yeah, I was just about to, I didn't want to interrupt, but it makes me think about when you was talking about the error rate. So like currently, the state of Tennessee is being, with Shelby County's health department being sued because of the fact of how they, the way they mishandled, like 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago, 3 summers ago, they decided to switch the system electronically. So that was like, and when they did that, it just went confused. I mean, people were getting cut off a month after they just got approved. I remember I had a similar situation with me 3 months in. They cut me off. Like, I had to go through an appeal. Like, I was awaiting in my appeals for a year and a half before I finally, like I said, about 2 years ago. It wasn't until this past September
after a year and a half wait where they finally answered my appeal. And it wasn't until January the 1st that I had actually got approved for my SNAP benefits. And it was happening across the city of Memphis. People's SNAP benefits was getting stolen. as soon as it drops into their car, they say they're looking an hour later, they're gone. A state like Tennessee, that's already one of the poorest, we're one of the poorest states in the country. Then they, with a high error rate, there's going to be situations where people are going to be approved or have to qualify for or eligible for it, but the state probably just not going to have the money to even get it. So it's like, what then?
I so appreciate that, Anthony, because that's so what it looks like. Do you know what I mean? In so many areas. For me, one of the things that I think it's important for the listeners, right? I super appreciate, Carolyn, what you were talking about as far as the numbers, even just the admin fees going from 50 to 75. I was at a conference recently and the head of human services there in South Carolina was just giving us some numbers, just like for people like me out in the audience, right? Sitting there who didn't know. And she said, just so you all are aware, just going from 50% to 75% of the administrative fees, I will have to go to our state legislature and ask for $32 million more just to cover that additional 25%. And South Carolina is not a huge state, right? So I think that just for the listeners, right? And Carolyn, I think a perfect, synopsis and a summary of what people in my community are afraid of, right? Because some people are only hearing propaganda pieces. Some people are only hearing from this news source, from that. Some people are only hearing from each other. Because when you're living, just trying to survive and thrive, right? But like listening to the news and reading a bunch of articles isn't really a part of that, right? It's about like going to birthday parties and taking your kids to the park when you're off work and not paying attention. And then you hear from a neighbor in a supermarket like, oh, you're using the EBT card. That's going to go away in 6 months. And then that's just what you think. And then that's what you tell everyone. So I think there's a lot of fear and I super appreciate what you just said there, Carolyn. But I also think it's important for the listener of the podcast to be aware that like going from 50% to 75% of admin costs in a smaller state like South Carolina is over $30 million, let alone what would have to be paid out in benefits. So like, we're not talking small amounts of money here.
No. And I think too, we have a one pager that we've taken to the Hill to show members of Congress, this is what the higher admin shift would mean. This is what the benefit cost shift would mean. And the numbers for big states like California or Texas or New York are staggering, like $1 billion. But then you even have small states like Wyoming where it's like, oh, it's just a couple of million. But for Wyoming, that's massive. Like they have a tiny budget because they don't have a lot of people there. So, it's devastating, I think, across the board.
Well, so this has just been a riveting, insightful conversation in terms of just like how this impact kind of translates to real life, right? I feel like a lot of the times when you hear this conversation, like you were talking about, Carolyn, you hear a lot of these technical terms and some categorical eligibility acronym, and it kind of just starts to feel like, I don't really know what any of that means. But now we're getting into some of these like impacts in community. And even how the states are reacting. We're starting to see how states are responding in positive ways in some instances, and then in some negative ways in terms of cutting people because they think the cost is going to be too much. And this is a question for all of you. What are the best ways for people to stay informed about what's happening since more will come out in the next few months, the next few weeks? And what can people do at the state level for them and their families and their communities access to food?
I'd like to start and just quickly put in a plug for continuing to stay engaged at the federal level and telling your members of Congress what these kinds of changes will mean for you. I've been telling people don't bank on everything getting rolled back and going back to the way it was before, but there's still a chance for that. And I don't think you can just stop and wait for other people to do that work for you or to say it's futile and not try. So again, telling your members of Congress what these changes would mean for you, I think are so important. And also staying in touch with state legislators, because now the ball's in their court to think, how are they going to deal with this uncertainty and these potential big cost shifts, to let them know what's important to you and that they should do everything they can to preserve SNAP access in your state and to not make really devastating cuts, but acknowledging they are going to have hard choices just because of what Congress put in front of them.
Yeah, I love that. I love, I, was intentionally specific about the state piece, but I love that you brought in the federal, because that can, that directly impacts that state advocacy. So thank you for bringing that to the forefront. I'm Z and Anthony. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I was just second, continuing to speak to your local reps, letting them know, sharing your story. I think storytelling is such a big impact. A lot of times they just look at the numbers, but they don't have no faces to them. If you're able to go to your state rep, go out there, go to the Hill, request meetings, sit down and talk to them, tell your story, tell them your lived experience, bring as many people as you can with you to go and tell them and put them in their faces and let them know, let them see the faces to the numbers that they're just throwing policies at. And there's something that Memphis does, and you can just do it locally, and not that, you know, it's just, you know, just create, you know, create community gardens. I mean, you know, the community has to, like, in this time, we have to kind of really build each other and work with each other to, you know, when it obviously seems like the government is not really caring the community in a sense. So, you know, I mean, just get out there, you know, help each other and stay informed as far as fact checking what you see on social media, read the news, pay attention, stay informed and pay attention, you know, but most definitely there's a lot that we can do. There really is a lot. So do not feel like you have no control over it. We are very powerful. These people are supposed to, you know, they're supposed to work. They work for us. I think we have to remember that we are the constituents and they must listen to our constituents. So put it out there. Let them hear your voice. Let them be loud. Be as loud as you can be.
Yeah, no, I love everything you said, and especially about the storytelling piece. I recently read a study that said, like, when storytelling is done well, the same neurons fire in the storyteller as the person who's listening. And so there's like a chemical cohesion that happens when stories are told effectively, and it can really lead to a level of understanding that is needed when doing this kind of work. And Z, last but certainly not least.
I super appreciate it. I love the question, you know, after talking about everything and how it feels, you know, it can feel a little hopeless, right? This piece at the end of, like, what can we do? And of course, I second, right? Reach out to Congress, reach out to your state legislature, reach out to your county and your city councils. And also, well, first I'm going to say, if your electeds are voting the way you want them to vote, right? And they're doing the things that you want them to be doing, reaching out to them is still important because they need a thank you, because they're in this vortex of crap, right? And so getting a thank you is incredibly helpful to remind them. So I think all of those pieces are real. But I'm also good at, yes, the community gardens and the taking care of your families and the food banks and the sharing food and all of those things within the community. I am also going to say something that may not be particularly popular, but I think it's also okay to take a step back if you need to for your mental health, right? I get a lot of bombardment on social media and email from friends. It's just one bill. I just need you to testify. Here's the writing. Just add your name. Anyone can do that. Do not shame people who are trying to survive, right? There are 1.5 million ways that we can fight against all of these things. And they do not all include reading the news every day and sticking your face in Congress and being miserable and having no energy left to play blocks with your 3-year-old at night. They do not all include that, right? When there is a sale at your local supermarket or when there's a farmer's market that's doing the double bucks for local food, you can also take a picture of that and post it on social media in your community group and let your neighbors know. And that is also you fighting to ensure that your family and your community has food. When I have the bandwidth, I am all in at conferences and reading the news and all of those things. And when I am not all in, it is the most unhelpful thing to have other people that I am on the same side as trying to guilt me into it, which all that does is create shame for me. And so I just want to end it by saying, like, absolutely, community gardens, read the news, reach out to your electeds, talk about it, post about it, write about it. And when you see a sale on popsicles at the grocery store, post that on your Instagram as well, because every kid on the planet deserves for their adult to say yes to popsicles every now and then, right? Like that is where I stand on that. There's work to be done, and it can be done any number of ways. Everyone deserves popsicles. So, yeah.
I love that, Z. One thing that we say sometimes in our team meetings is that joy is a form of resistance. Community is a form of resistance. And so I just love ending it on that note. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I love that too, Hobson. Joy is resistance. And I think we could all use that reminder from time to time. And this also feels like the right time and the right place to close things out. But before we wrap up, though, I want to thank our panelists by name. Anthony, C, Carolyn, we're so grateful for the time and wisdom you shared with us today. Thank you for being with us. And just like we talked about today, remember that taking action doesn't have to look just one way. It could be calling your representatives. It could be showing up at the State House. It could be planting a garden, sharing food with your neighbors, or even letting folks know about good deals at the local supermarket. Every one of those big or small steps helps us build stronger communities where our families are fed and every kid gets to enjoy a popsicle every now and again. So thank you for being with us. Please remember to take care of yourselves and, more importantly, each other. And we'll see you next time for another episode of The Bold and the Brave, a parent-leader podcast. Thank you.